Good afternoon. Today I'm going to be introducing a lot of the new features coming out in Windows Server 2012 R2 failover clustering. So this is actually the first time a lot of these features have been announced. So I'm going to spend some time not just kind of telling you what the feature does, but kind of the design principles that we made behind it, thinking about how you can implement it, use these different features as best practices. I'm Simon Perryman, a senior technical evangelist with Microsoft, and prior to my current role, I spent about 4 years on the cluster engineering team, actually building a lot of these products that we're going to be covering today. Now, as we get started and walk through this deck, we're going to really focus on four key areas here. Designing clusters, deploying clusters, managing clusters, and then advanced management integration with System Center 2012. Now, first, we're going to talk about cluster design. Most people kind of think of clusters as very basic, right? You just have the host, but we can actually use clustering throughout our stack, throughout our data center. Now, as we think of high availability, though, it's important to consider, you know, throughout the stack, including our hardware layer. Servers, storage, networking. We then think about workload availability. This is the more traditional clustering you're familiar with, where you have the physical host and you fail over applications or virtual machines between those hosts. We have guest clustering or guest application high availability. This is where I have two virtual machines that form a failover cluster, and I can fail over my application running within the virtual machine. We then have storage availability for our VMs using our scale-out file server. So this means we have distributed access for our virtual machines on its back-end storage, highly available virtual machine storage. We have management high availability using the System Center products, making sure that our management systems stay resilient. And then finally, we're going to touch on site high availability, multi-site clustering. What happens if you lose an entire data center? How can you be resilient? How can you fail over? Primarily, we're going to focus on these four topics here, though. System Center, guest clustering, host clustering, and file server clustering. So let's first talk about hardware availability. Now, this is a dense slide. I'm not going to go through this in detail because a lot of this information about hardware availability has been around for a while. Kind of the key message here is you want to think about redundancy everywhere. Eliminate single points of failure. A single point of failure, take down your entire system. So as we think of our servers, we want redundant roles, Active Directory, DNS, DHCP. We want redundancy in our system, our processors, our memory. We want redundancy in our storage using things such as multipath I/O, RAID. Redundancy in our networking, multiple networks, NIC teaming. Let's move on to the cluster piece, what we find most interesting here, and talk a little bit about host clustering. Now, this is our traditional failover clustering model you guys are probably most familiar with our two physical servers. Now, benefits of this, you lose some hardware. We could fail over, come back online. We detect the health of the applications, so if an application crashes, becomes unavailable, we could restart that application. We could even peek inside virtual machines. If a virtual machine has a blue screen, a user mode hang, we could detect that, we could restart that. Essentially, our goal here is to provide hardware using our physical servers and move our applications around. Guest clustering was introduced in Windows Server 2008 when we started supporting Hyper-V version 1. Again, guest clustering is where we cluster our virtualized layer. Basically, you install Windows Server in your guest operating system and form a failover cluster out of that. So what are the benefits? Well, if you just have a virtual machine that's running on a cluster, but that virtual machine is a standalone VM, what happens when you need to patch that? You have downtime. What happens if the application within that virtual machine crashes? Will it automatically recover? Maybe, maybe not. This is the key advantage of using guest clustering. We're providing the same benefits of host clustering, but within our virtualized layer. So we could do patching by failing over our applications between our two virtual machines. If a SQL server that's running inside a VM crashes, the guest cluster could detect it, restart that SQL instance. So we're providing high availability inside the virtualized layer. We strongly encourage all of our customers to use this if they're using virtual machines, have a highly virtualized environment. We then have storage clustering. This was introduced in Windows Server 2012 with the scale-out file server. Now what this does, it basically provides multiple access paths on a file server cluster. So if you think about what traditional file server clustering was, if you done clustering back in 2008, 2003, or earlier, you basically had a client access point that was running on a cluster. So think of this as whack, whack, my share. If that server crashed, that share would go offline. We'd have to update all the cluster members. It would fail over, update cluster membership again, come back online, update cluster membership again, and then clients could reconnect. But this caused extended downtime. What we can do with the scale-out file server is essentially put that whack, whack, my share on all of our nodes on the cluster. This way, if one of those shares goes down, one of those hosts goes down, the clients can quickly redirect themselves to another file share with the exact same path name. Now, another big advantage of this, if you're doing a large file copy, let's say, and you're using something like Xcopy, Robocopy, something more than just the Windows shell drag copy and paste thing, it will automatically reconnect. So if you're copying from a server, the server crashes, client gets reconnected to a different scale-out file server, that file copy operation will continue. They probably won't even notice a difference unless they're literally watching the screen and notice this slight transient failover. Now, this is going to be very interesting for you if you're using virtual machines. The reason why is Windows Server 2012 started supporting virtual machines that run over SMB. SMB is a networking protocol. And what we could do is we could reroute our virtual machines and have our VHD files stored on this file server cluster. And so what this means is if this one of the nodes on the file server cluster crashes, the VM won't hang, the VM won't freeze. Our VM will continue running, go through another path, and reconnect to its VHD with no downtime to the virtual machine. So basically, by using this, we're providing high availability for our VM storage. Highly recommended if you're in a highly virtualized environment. Next, we look at the management layer with System Center. Now, we have other sessions throughout the week that really focus on System Center high availability. So I'm not going to focus so much on all of the System Center high availability, but really focus on what's interesting as it relates to clustering. Now, all the System Center components, they have some type of management server. This is basically the brain of System Center, what keeps things running, what keeps things online. Now, we want to make sure that that server stays healthy as well. What happens if your operations manager server crashes? Well, you're going to lose the ability to detect other problems in your environment. What happens if your VMM management server crashes? Well, you're not going to be able to deploy new VMs. You're not going to monitor the health of the host. You're not going to be able to do dynamic load balancing, dynamic optimization. So we really want to focus on keeping management high availability as well. Now, for the most part, basic rules of our System Center high availability. Every component can run in a virtual machine, and that virtual machine can be clustered. This is going to be your easiest solution. Run DPM in a virtual machine, Ops Manager in a virtual machine, etc. Now, all of the System Center components use SQL Server 2012 as their backend database. We want to make sure that that information stays available as well, because these management servers are constantly pulling information from this backend database. Since it's SQL, we can use SQL clustering. SQL Server 2012, always on. Use our availability groups, so we can provide resiliency through clustering for the SQL server that's running on the back end. Now, I'm not going to spend, again, much time going through these other high availability solutions with one exception, two exceptions, the VMM library server and the VMM management server. Now, the VMM management server, since Windows Server 2012, can now be deployed directly on a failover cluster. Not within a VM on a cluster, but directly on the host. It has its own resource DLL, so it could be a first-class citizen of the cluster. As soon as it freezes, it hangs, the host can detect that, and it will fail over that VMM management server to a different host. We highly recommend this. Now, it is still fully supported to go and run that VMM server inside a virtual machine, but you have to think, anytime you run something within a VM, you kind of have that extra layer of abstraction. It could take a little longer to detect failures, detect when the service has gone down. But by running that VMM management server directly on the bare metal, we could detect as soon as it crashes, fail it over quickly, bring it online quickly. The second VMM component that uses clustering is the library server. Now, the library server is essentially where you store all of your information, the things that you're going to deploy within VMs. So this would be like your ISO files, VHDs, all of your host profiles, guest OS profiles, application profiles. Essentially, it's your database of things that you want to go and put inside your virtualized environment. We want to make sure that's highly available. If you need to scale out quickly, you need to copy things from that file server. We want to make sure that that's always going to be online, always available. So you could actually use clustering as part of this library server. Next, let's quickly cover site high availability. Now, this is going to be important if you're in a, well, you know what? Pretty much any data center, you need to think about site high availability. The reason why, you want to avoid losing the entire data center, right? If we think of recent disasters, you know, tornadoes, Hurricane Sandy, wildfires, major power outages, these disasters really do happen. So we want to try to think about resiliency as well across our different sites. Now, essentially, what we're doing here is placing nodes in different data centers. This way, we can survive the loss of an entire data center. But one of the key things you have to keep in mind is making sure that the data is going to be available on both locations, right? If all of our data is on data center one burns to the ground, we've lost our data. So key thing here, you need to think about replication. How can I copy my information from my primary site over to my second site, making sure it's reliable, making sure that I can always get access to it when I need. Now, another key thing that you want to think about is using automation with multi-site clustering. One of the challenges that we find with disasters is, well, people have other priorities. You know what? If you're a data center admin, there's a hurricane hitting, you're probably not going to be staying in the data center doing live migrations of your virtual machines, right? You're going to go home, take care of family, have other priorities. So we really want to encourage you thinking about automation as part of this disaster planning. Because the biggest reason why disaster recovery fails, human error. Everything was well tested, but there was a human in the way. Human made a mistake. Human had other priorities. The disaster recovery plan didn't fail. So we really want to encourage you to think about automation as part of this process. Now, failover clustering since 2003 has supported what we call multi-site clustering, where we're stretching this network, stretching our nodes across these different locations. But Windows Server 2012, we added a new feature called the Hyper-V replica. Hyper-V replica allows us to do point-in-time replication from our primary site over to our secondary site for virtual machines. Now, this doesn't mean that it's just limited to copying VMs. Remember, you can run anything you want inside those virtual machines. So you have your SQL database in a VM, replicate that. Your other infrastructure servers within the VM, replicate that. So using Hyper-V replica, we have some great enhancements as a completely free in-box replication solution. And we made some enhancements to this in this release that I'm going to be covering shortly. One of the other features that we announced this week, brand new, is the Windows Azure Hyper-V Recovery Manager. We briefly mentioned this in the keynote. Essentially, what this does is allow us to coordinate large-scale failovers from a primary data center to a secondary data center via Windows Azure. So you don't need to be physically located in one of the data centers or the other. You basically connect up to Windows Azure, configure this information, and when you need to do a failover, planned or unplanned, you could go and push the big red button that says move my information. And it'll gradually and serially copy everything from your primary site to the secondary site, giving you detailed reporting of how everything's moving. So a great solution to further enhance the management of this. So let's focus on cluster deployment. What's new in Windows Server 2012? Well, first of all, we wanted to make it easy for people to adopt clustering. We have a lot of customers that are, you know, building these brand new data centers, these new private clouds. They know everything's going to be highly available, highly virtualized. How do you get started? Well, oftentimes that can be a challenge. Now, nice thing about clustering is we support any hardware so long as it meets two requirements. Everything needs a logo for Windows Server 2012. The entire solution cannot fail any of our validation tests. So you can use your own hardware, any hardware you have, as long as you meet these. But if you're brand new to a cluster deployment, thinking about what's the easiest way to get up and running, consider working with one of our OEMs. Now, these OEMs, they ship what we call cluster in a box or data center in a crate. Essentially, they will literally drop off a pallet of resources with everything pre-configured, your storage, your networking, all of this information. And you simply plug in redundant power cables, redundant internet connections, boot up the first server, and it will give you very simple guided instructions to go through this cluster deployment. You could even deploy domain controllers through this. So if you want to set up a brand new environment from scratch with your own Active Directory information, fill out a couple forms, do this from a single interface, and you can get your cluster up and running in about 30 minutes. Now, as we look at our SKU choices, as you're thinking about what version you're going to use, no changes since 2012. We basically have three different versions that we're going to use with failover clustering. We have Windows Server Standard Edition, Windows Server Data Center Edition, and then the Hyper-V Server. So kind of the key considerations, key differences here. Hyper-V Server, you don't get any extra licenses for your guest operating system. The reason why is we give Hyper-V Server away for free. I'm going to spend a little longer on that on my next slide. Windows Server Standard Edition, you're going to select this if you're not in a highly virtualized environment. For every host operating system you get two licenses for guest operating systems that also run Windows Server Standard. If you're in a highly virtualized environment, you're going to want to go with the Data Center Edition. You buy your host license, you get unlimited licenses for all of your VM guests. So you don't have to worry about licensing compliance as you start to spin up VMs and have this highly dynamic, highly scalable, highly virtualized environment. Now, other main difference between these is that Hyper-V Server is a core SKU, a core installation. There is no graphical user interface as part of this. Now, Hyper-V Server, we mentioned before, is a free download. Okay, you could go to downloads.microsoft.com, download this today. Now, of course, the 2012 R2 version is not available yet. Talking about the 2012 RTM version. So why does Microsoft give this away for free? Well, simple, we want people using our server. We want people using Hyper-V. But key thing to keep in mind, this is not a full edition of Windows Server. Okay, it does not include file services, Active Directory, IIS. All this is the hypervisor that supports clustering. So great way for you to get free licenses for all of your host infrastructure. So let's say you're budget conscious and you want to keep it also a little cheap for your guest operating systems. Remember, we don't include any licenses. You can run Linux inside your guest operating systems. Free host, free guest. So a great solution to start kind of trying out, starting to adopt this Microsoft technology. Now, one of the biggest, you know, things that people are afraid of with using Hyper-V Server is this no graphical user interface. It's okay, there's lots of ways to work around this. Now, if you actually log directly onto the system, it's not just a command prompt. You actually see what's called sc-config, this blue box here. Sc-config will always launch as soon as you launch Hyper-V Server, and it will kind of guide you through the most common tasks. Join a domain, join a network, enable clustering, enable Windows updates. So it kind of starts to guide you through this process. But there's also third parties that actually allow you to install a GUI on top of this. So Five Nines, for example, they have some network configuration solutions that they can use. So you can actually load third-party GUIs into Hyper-V Server. But what we recommend is using remote management. Microsoft, we really want to be scalable, allow you to manage lots of servers from a single interface. And so we support remote management of your Hyper-V servers through Hyper-V Manager, Failover Cluster Manager, PowerShell, System Center Virtual Machine Manager. So you have a lot of solutions, a lot of options here to make sure that you can manage it with a full graphical user interface, even though it's a core box. Actually, one more I forgot as well, Remote Server Administration Tools, RSAT, which is basically your server manager tools that you can run on a client machine. Full remote connection support. The best thing about this, we don't put any limitations on Hyper-V Server. It supports 8,000 virtual machines, just like the full edition. It supports 64 node clusters, just like the full edition. It supports all the new types of live migration, just like the full edition. Storage live migration, SMB network live migration, shared nothing live migration. So a great solution if you're trying it out, want to go highly scalable, have any concerns about licensing. Now, as you go and install your server edition, you do have different options for what type of installation type. This is assuming you buy standard edition or data center edition. You have the core, which is just a little command prompt. You have min shell, which is basically a command prompt, plus some small GUI tools for some of the harder configurations. You have the full edition, which is probably the version you're most used to. And then you have the full with desktop experience. And that's basically running like the Aero graphics, the nice UI, which we don't want to recommend really. You want to use on a server. What we really recommend is using the minimum version possible. Ideally, use core. The reason why we want to do this is to provide higher availability. Now, if you think about a graphical user interface, you think about all these additional components that are added to a system, that's more things that need to be patched, have security vulnerabilities, Guess what? More patches means more reboots. More reboots, lower availability. So what we want to do is try to encourage people, go with the minimum version possible, manage it remotely, so you're going to have less patching of those systems. Now, Hyper-V Server, the version I was just talking about, takes it even further. Since it's only Hyper-V, only clustering, and then has a few networking and storage components built in, that's even fewer things to service than this full version. So again, Hyper-V Server, a great solution for you. So let's talk about network planning and what's changed with Windows Server 2012 R2. Now, in the past, one of the biggest challenges we found from our customers were the number of NICs, the number of network cards that you actually needed to provide. So we used to recommend you might need up to 6 NICs, and you know, a lot of blades, they're limited to just 4. How can we get around this? You know, you need a network card for your actual applications for the public to access them. You used to need a network card for your internal cluster communication, so updates, health checks, that type of thing. You needed a network for live migration if you were doing VMs. You needed a network for server management, host management. So let's say you're deploying a VM to that host. It's a 10 gigabyte file. You want to have a dedicated network so it doesn't impact anything else. Then depending on what storage you were using, you may need, if you were using Ethernet-based storage, iSCSI, Fiber Channel over Ethernet, SMB, yet another NIC. And most backup solutions also recommend a dedicated NIC. So we were looking at oftentimes 6 NICs in the environment. So this definitely wasn't ideal. What we're really seeing a lot of our customers do and have great success with is using converged networks, moving up from these 1 gigabyte up to 10 gigabyte, teaming them. And so instead of having 6 NICs that are running 1 each, you have a pair that are running 10. Greater throughput, greater resiliency, had a lot of positive feedback on this. So something to think about as you start to make your future hardware investments. Now for VMs, if you're a highly virtualized environment, consider using some of the hardware offloading capabilities that are built directly into the networking cards, such as VMQ, SRIOV. Essentially, this allows us to do more processing actually on the network card itself, which means we're not doing processing on the server, providing more resources to actually run those virtual machines. So highly virtualized environment, you're buying new NICs, think about these 10 gigi that support the latest and greatest virtualization features. Let's move on to storage. Cluster Shared Volumes has expanded its interoperability support. By the way, this is all brand new. You guys are the first guys to see this information here. Now, what we wanted to do with CSV was treat it as a first-class file system, not have limitations such as regular storage you can do this, CSV you can't. Wanted to build interoperability throughout Cluster Shared Volumes. So let's quickly walk through these new enhancements. First is supporting REFS, which is our new resilient file system, something that we hope to eventually phase out NTFS with. REFS wasn't supported in 2012 RTM, now supported in 2012 R2. And we want to recommend our customers use this because it really is more resilient, gives you higher availability. Challenge, you still have to check whether the applications support it. Pretty much all the Microsoft ones do. Third parties still got to check on that. We have CSV cache. Now, this was actually introduced in 2012 RTM and enhanced in 2012 R2 with write-back caching. Now, what CSV cache is, basically, cluster shared volumes, we tended to find that a lot of information was reused. It was the same 10% of information that was constantly being read, going up and down through the networks. So in 2012 RTM, you had the ability to turn on a CSV cache to actually store locally a collection of this common information that's most commonly read. This means that you're doing less reads and writes to the actual storage because this cache is living on the server. So you have less I.O., faster reads, faster reads. Now, the difference in 2012 R2 is that we now support writing, read and write to the cache. So this cache used to be read-only, so it would take a while for us to kind of build up the cache. Now it's read and write, so we've increased support, so you get even faster I.O., even faster throughput, less interaction with the storage if you have the CSV cache up and running. Next thing we wanted to add support for was tiered spaces. So you heard one of the big storage enhancements this release, storage tiering. You got your fast SSDs up front, slower JBODs in the middle, and then maybe some tape on the back end that you're writing to. Full support using cluster shared volumes on your first two tiers. If you're using just JBODs with storage spaces, we support that. If you're using our SSDs, we support that using cluster shared volumes. Parity spaces with CSV. So this is just one of the components that most storage systems use to actually have a parity bit to check the consistency of a disk. We didn't have parity bit support in CSV before, added it in 2012 R2. A big one is deduplication on cluster shared volumes. We found our customers have lots and lots of VMs on a CSV disk. In RTM, we didn't support dedupe. 2012 R2, we now support deduplication. But what's further, we don't just support that when the VMs are saved in a library on a disk. We can now do deduplication for online running virtual machines that are running on the CSV disk. So think of this for VDI, right? 90% of the data in a VDI environment's identical. You can now say 90% of your data in a highly virtualized VDI environment with all of these VMs online, all of them running. And this could save some of our large customers millions of dollars in storage costs every year. And then we added System Center integration with cluster shared volumes. Configuration Manager supports monitoring, deploying services, making sure that these CSV disks are compliant and they have the right firmware and patches. Data Protection Manager supports backing up CSV disks and VMs that are running on those CSV disks. Operations Manager allows us to monitor our CSV volumes, make sure that they're healthy, monitor the amount of storage space when they start to approach 100% utilization, spin up a warning. Orchestrator via Virtual Machine Manager allows us to go and deploy VMs to CSV volumes. Now I want to clarify, Orchestrator cannot directly talk to the failover clustering resource. It has to go through Virtual Machine Manager as the intermediary. So Orchestrator talks to VMM, VMM then talks to the cluster. But VMM added support as well for cluster shared volumes. We can just better monitor them. We can actually create CSV disks, full functionality of cluster shared volumes using Virtual Machine Manager. But probably one of the biggest enhancements we found our customers most excited about that we've had early release disclosure to is shared VHDX file. Now, shared VHDX, why did we decide to do this? Well, we started to speak to a lot of hosters. The challenge that we heard from hosters was if they wanted to create a guest cluster, which is, again, our virtual machines that are interconnected, the challenge that they had was they would need to go and present their storage information, their storage disks, their storage drives to these tenants. So basically, you know, you had public people that were creating guest clusters having access to your own storage infrastructure. That could kind of be a little scary. What we can do with shared VHDX is create a VHDX file, so this is just literally a file, and expose that to both nodes of these virtual machines. So we're no longer giving these tenants access to our storage infrastructure, we're giving them access to files that are running somewhere on our storage infrastructure, but they don't have that visibility into the underlying storage fabric. So think about this as a great security enhancement. Furthermore, it's easier to set up. Now, some common questions I get. Can you go and use shared VHDX on physical servers? No. Shared VHDX is for guest clusters only. It's one of our new guest cluster and storage protocols. How do I configure it? Well, basically, you go and create a VHDX file on one node. On the second node through Hyper-V Manager, you add that as storage. We now have shared VHDX files. Now, as far as guest clustering goes, in our last release, we used to support Fibre Channel storage. We had a virtualized HBA for Fibre Channel. iSCSI storage, SMB storage. This is what you can kind of consider as the fourth option, our shared VHDX file. So think of this as what we use our application data for. So I have a SQL database running in my guest cluster. That actual database runs in that shared VHDX file. Cluster validation. We wanted to make it better, wanted to make it faster. So we've improved our algorithms around storage validation. We no longer online and test every single disk against every single node in the cluster. We've now expanded up to 64 node clusters. That's going to take a while. So we made a lot of optimizations around our storage to make this faster, make this more resilient. You now have the ability to select specific ones to test. You could keep the resource online, keep the resource offline. Now, in the past, you'd have to select all of your storage at once. It was an all or nothing. Now you can just select these specific ones to test. We now support and can approve of replicated storage in a multi-site cluster. In our older version, if we saw replicated storage, we would just say, warning, we have no idea what this is. Move on. You guys go speak to your storage vendors. Now we will actually test this replicated storage, make sure that it maps across these different components, across the two different sites. We've improved our network reliability. Now, what we used to do, as far as our networking goes, as far as our health checks go, we basically use pings. So health checks are making sure that one node can speak to the second node, make sure that they're healthy, make sure that they're online. We never tested this in validation. And in some cases, we found out that servers would have ports that we needed to do that heartbeating through closed. So cluster communicates through port 3343. And if you had that disabled, the cluster couldn't do heartbeating. So when you brought your cluster online, none of the nodes could health check each other, and the cluster would shut itself back down. And we didn't have good diagnostics unless you knew exactly what that problem was. So now as part of validation, we're going to go and check that those ports are open that we need to do our health checking through. And finally, we've added a set of Hyper-V tests, where we're really trying to ensure that your server is going to be optimized and work well if it's a Hyper-V environment. Now I'm going to switch over to my demo environment and quickly walk through some of this Hyper-V. Now over here, I got to just first promote this tool as one of the best tools for cluster management. This is called Remote Desktop Connection Manager. Basically allows you to manage lots and lots of remote desktop connections at scale with a simple interface. You know, you can connect to multiple servers at once by simply saying, connect the group. It has passwords built in. If I go and add a new server, it will go and actually take the password from the parent, add it to that. So you don't even have to worry about like password management. Extremely easy to use interface. So I highly recommend it if you have a lot of clusters to manage. In this case, I'm using about 5 or 6 different clusters across all different versions here. So I find it extremely helpful to never have to remember any of my remote desktop connections' names. And best of all, this is another free download from Microsoft.com. Question? Sorry? Who is the owner of RDC, man? So historically, there was a team at Microsoft that was the actual owner of this component. That team has since been broken apart, no longer there. So this component's now moved onto the remote desktop team at Microsoft. Right now, I actually spoke to them about this maybe 2 weeks ago. Right now, they have no plans to improve a new version, but this version is really cool. So just try it out. And again, completely free download, downloads.microsoft.com. Interesting. Okay, apparently there's an internal 2.5 release coming out soon. Thank you. All right, so let's connect over here, and this is my Windows Server 2012 R2 cluster. Now, I'm going to go down and take a look at my main management system here, and you're going to see a few changes as part of this main portal here. So first of all, you're going to notice that some of the terminology has changed. We no longer have a migrator cluster wizard. It's called copy cluster roles. There's a lot of confusion about the terminology migrate once we started to have live migration. Essentially, this is our way to go and copy resources from one cluster over to a newer cluster. And we're going to take a look at this a little more a little later. We have integration with cluster-aware updating now. As I scroll down to my core cluster resources, I get information about my servers or my IP addresses. So everything's looking pretty healthy here. Now, as I go take a look at my nodes, one of the big improvements that you're going to see here as part of the UI is looking at different voting. So we made some improvements into our UI to show which nodes are currently voting as part of our quorum configuration, which nodes are not. I have a big section on quorum changes later, so just going to tease you with that for now. Under our disks and under our storage, we can now see who owns a particular storage resource. Huge customer question, you know, what disk is currently being owned? What's my CSV coordinator node? We expose all of this in the UI so you can quickly figure out disk ownership, where traffic is being routed through. But let's go back to our validation reports here. Take a look at our Hyper-V configuration. Now, I've actually failed one of these tests here, and so this would mean that if I was using virtualized SAN, this would be an unsupported configuration. Now, remember, when we're doing clustering, we always need to pass 2 requirements to have a fully supported cluster. Everything has to be logoed, everything has to pass these validation tests. So I want to make sure that I go back and fix this. Essentially, what we've done with the Hyper-V configuration is broken this down into 4 different categories. We have requirements. So these are going to be things such as making sure that you have matching processor manufacturers. Everything's AMD, everything is Intel. This is so we can support live migration between these two different servers. We then have information. So list any current virtual machines that are running on any host. So informational stuff. We then have compatibility. So as we look at compatibility, this is making sure that all of our networks, virtualized networks, have the same name across every node in the cluster. When we move my VM from node 1 to node 2, we're not updating that virtual machine's configuration file. It's still using my network 1. So we want to make sure that it can persist using that my network 1 when it moves from that first server over to that second server. So we're going to check for these best practices as part of this deployment. And then finally, configuration. So this is making sure that all of our additional workloads, additional components that are going to be integrated with clustering are configured correctly as well. So essentially, what we're trying to do here is make sure that as soon as you get your Hyper-V cluster up and running, it's going to be supported, it's going to work. Now, when you actually kick off and initiate validation, if a single node that you're going to validate has the Hyper-V role installed, that's when we will go and start running those additional set of tests. Now, furthermore, a lot of people don't know this, but we actually run an additional set of tests on the cluster if it's already up and running. We run what we call cluster configuration best practices. So, again, this is the type of information you get as you're deploying the cluster. But remember, you can run cluster validation at any point in time. Use it as a troubleshooting tool. Use it as a best practice analyzer. Anytime there's a problem, go run cluster validation before calling product support. Because guess what product support's going to do? They're going to tell you, run cluster validation. So this could often help you save time, help you save some churn. Now, as part of our best practice analyzer tests, you get a full new category that are going to make sure that everything is optimized for the cluster. So specifically, it's looking at the new workloads that you've deployed on a cluster. Now, for example, it will go and look at what type of disk online operation every resource is using. It will say, hey, you're using long check disk. This means that it's going to slow down the time it takes for you to bring a disk online after a failure by a couple minutes. You should change it to the fast check disk. This way it's only going to spend about a couple seconds making sure that this disk is still going to work before bringing it online, making sure it's consistent. So it really goes down to the granular level of individual cluster properties. So definitely a good thing to run. If you already have a cluster up and running today, just go run validate again, see what it comes back with. Now, another example is if you have virtual machines that are clustered, we're going to go and check that the integration components are matching and are the same compatible versions with the host and the guest. So a lot of nice built-in logic to help keep your cluster online and more resilient. Cluster upgrades. So how do we move from our old version to our new version? Well, first of all, we now support cross-version live migration for our virtual machines. This means you can live migrate your VMs that are currently running on 2012 RTM up to 2012 R2 RTM. So this allows you to move your virtual machines between these different infrastructure with zero downtime. Now, you still need to go and upgrade the integration components within those virtual machines. Yes, that causes downtime when you upgrade the integration components. So what we recommend as part of this is next time you start the virtual machine, that's when you upgrade the integration components. So you're starting it anyway, no additional downtime. Now, you also have to consider, if you're using one of these broad multi-cluster topologies like I showed in the beginning, where you have that physical cluster, that virtualized cluster, that file server cluster, got to think about upgrading all these different layers as well. So upgrading the file servers, doing a migration from the old to the new. Upgrading the guest cluster from the old to the new. Now, the copy cluster role wizard will copy any type of cluster, whether it's physical or virtual. Now, what we're actually doing, we're not actually doing anything disruptive. We're not actually taking anything offline on the old cluster, bringing it online on the new cluster. We are literally copying all of the data and configuration information over. And then it's up to you. When you offline the old version, online the new version. So a lot of customers like to just test a migration before they do it in production. And so part of our migration process, it actually includes pre-migration reports and post-migration reports. Now let's actually jump over to the demo system again and walk you through a very brief overview of how we can upgrade from an older cluster to a newer cluster. So over here I have a Windows Server 2012 cluster. I'll just open this up, show you what we have here. I last used this over at TechEd Africa. And I can see that I have a couple virtual machines running on this host. Some of them are online, some of them are offline, different priorities. Let me go back to my new cluster, my 2012 R2 cluster. And over here, go to my copy cluster roles wizard. Now what it's going to do me here is say, what's your old cluster? Where are we pulling this information from? So in this case, I'm just going to specify one of my nodes in my old cluster. You can also specify the cluster name, anything would work. It's going to then go connect to the old cluster, make sure that I have security credentials. Assuming I do, it's then going to go and analyze all these different resources that are running on the old cluster. Virtual machines, disks, this type of information. And then it gives me a list of things that I can go and copy. In this case, I could copy VMs. I could copy my replication broker. We'll talk some more about that later. But if I had file servers, other resources, I'd see these listed as well, be able to copy that information over. Now, one thing that you're going to note here is that I actually have two different VMs that are grouped together. If I select this checkbox, it automatically selects both of these VMs. I can't just select one of them. So why do we do that? Well, what we're doing here is those two virtual machines are running on the same CSV disk. So if I go back to my old cluster, I can take a look at VM low and VM service, and I'm going to see that these are both going to be using CSV disk one. Got to go to my Hyper-V settings instead. So CSV volume one. Now, the reason why we enforce it bringing both VMs that are running on the same CSV disk is we actually do CSV disk mapping. So our goal is to look at how many CSV disks you have on your old cluster, how many CSV disks you have on your new cluster, and give you the ability to map them. Now, you also, and actually most customers, they don't even update their storage. Most customers continue to use the same storage as they go through. At one point, they'll offline the VMs on their old cluster, disconnect the storage, reconnect it to the new cluster, bring those VMs online on the new cluster. Let's go back to the wizard and see what else it does here. So I'm gonna go ahead and select this group and this group. And look at this, I get my pre-migration report. Now, the intention of this is to tell you what's going to be migratable, what is not going to be migratable before you do anything. Now, we have task scheduler tasks. We can't copy those tasks. We have some additional manual steps after copying some roles. We have things that can be copied successfully. So it kind of gives me a good start to understand what's going to happen, what's not going to work. Let's go back to the wizard. That all looks good. Let's select next. And then we get to actually remap our virtualized networks. So one of the key things here is we want our VMs to always work, right, after we bring them online. Now, the virtual machine network that we're going to use for this VM is stored in the virtual machine's configuration file. It says VM1 uses network 1. Well, chances are, or there's a possibility when you go and move your VMs over to your new cluster, you have different virtualized network names. And so what we're doing here is giving you an opportunity to map the network on your old cluster to the network on your new cluster. And as part of the migration process, we will go update that configuration file and say, now you're going to use this new network. So you can bring those VMs online immediately without having to change any of the different network settings. So let's go and select this network. Now, if I click View Report again, it will give me additional information about the networking. But I'm going to skip that report, copy these over, and then just take a look at my final report here. Because this kind of gives me the detail of what exactly happened. So everything came over, got all my information saved, perfect. Now, just like traditional clustering that we've had for a while, we always save our cluster reports for any actions that we do. So if I go open my file and I go to C, Windows, Cluster, Reports, I get all of these Create Cluster, Copy Virtual Machine, all this information available here. So this gives me the same pre-migration report. So what this means to you, you don't have to worry about inventorying it, copying it down. If a problem happens with the migration, you can always go back later. We never delete these reports, always save for you. So you can always see what has happened within your cluster. So what can you deploy on a cluster? Well, we find about 95% of our customers use clustering for four roles: Hyper-V, SQL, File, and Exchange. But clustering can be used for almost anything. You can even customize it by using one of our generic containers. Now, a generic container is basically either a script, so .vbs, .powershell, one of those, a executable file, so this is a generic application, .exe, or a generic service. So if you have a custom service that you're using, anything you can see in Service Control Manager, Windows Services, you could go and cluster that as well. So if you have custom line of business applications, walk through a wizard, enter what type of application you want to make highly available, store that application's data on the shared storage, so both nodes can access it, and it can actually become a highly available resource. If it crashes, we'll restart it. We can fail it over if a host crashes. So you can already start to integrate your own business applications on a failover cluster. But if you want more advanced integration, you can also write your own resource DLL. A resource DLL basically makes your own application a first-class citizen on a cluster. Now, using those generic templates, you have limited configuration. Writing your own resource DLL, you can basically do anything you want with the cluster. Now, what the resource DLL is, it's essentially a mapping of the action that we need to understand, such as bring a resource online, bring a resource offline, check the health of a resource, to the specific command for your application. So maybe to start your application, it's net start myapp.exe. You would basically map that to cluster online. And this way, when we want to bring the resource online, we will go and run that specific command that you specify. Very granular how you can build this, how you can configure this. But this allows you to run any application just about on top of our cluster. So let's move on to cluster management. Now, key message that we really want to emphasize in 2012 R2 is that Hyper-V clusters are different. We're now going to start treating them as different. We no longer have a one-size cluster fits all. We realize that Hyper-V has different resource constraints. So first of all, we've already talked about our cluster validation tests, both before you actually deploy the cluster, prior to that pre-configuration, as well as when the cluster's already up and running, those additional best practice tests. We talked about the VHDX already, a new enhancement to really abstract the storage layer even further. The next thing is that we reconfigure our heartbeat settings for a Hyper-V cluster. As soon as you add the first virtual machine to that cluster, we go and update our heartbeating timeouts. Now remember, this heartbeating is a health check. It's saying, are you healthy? Are you healthy? And the recipient has to send it, and then the other receiving node has to respond and send that back. Now, what we found is, sometimes in a highly virtualized environment, those heartbeats weren't getting through. You had networks that had different types of traffic going through them. If you're doing a live migration, right, that saturates the network. Sometimes those pings weren't getting through. That was triggering false failovers. This other node was actually healthy. This node couldn't see it, and so we turned it off, failed all of our resources over, and that can actually incur unplanned downtime, unwanted downtime. So what we tried to do with this release is adjust these settings, optimize them for Hyper-V virtual machines, when you have those networks that have that high amount of traffic. And we do all of this for you automatically. And what this means is we're not sending these heartbeats as fast. We're sending them much slower now, waiting longer until we trigger a failover, with the intention of making it more resilient. The next change that we do are updates to our clustered database membership. Now, for some background, some internals, how does cluster database work? Now, basically, our cluster database is our single consistent state view of what's happening in the cluster at any point in time. Basically, this database is under the registry, hklm.cluster or /cluster, and what this does is it keeps track of every single clustered workload, every property, every state. So for example, it will have virtual machine 1. These are all how it was configured. Its current state is online. These are the private properties. Now, what we need to do is always have a consistent view of what's happening across a cluster. And so what we're doing as part of this database update is anytime a resource changes on one node, we immediately go and update every other node in the cluster. So let's say I bring a VM online. That's a state change. I then have to go and tell all the other nodes in the cluster, maybe 63 other nodes, that this change has happened. But then I also have to wait for an acknowledgement to come back so that everyone has seen the update. Then I will go and actually perform that action and bring in the resource online. Again, when we make a change, we send out the change, we wait for an acknowledgement back, then we go and make that change. Now, the problem that we found was, again, with these networks that might be highly saturated. Those update messages, they run through what we call our Global Update Manager, or GUM. Those updates sometimes weren't getting through. We'd send this request, we would wait. And then once that network finally cleared, only then would we get the acknowledgement back. And so this caused delays in the time it took to start up our virtual machines, right? Because we're now waiting for all of these acknowledgements to come back. And so this actually kind of increased the time it would take to bring these resources online after a failover. And this was particularly tough if you had a stretched cluster, multiple sites, when you're actually sending this information and waiting for these acknowledgements over a public network. So what we did with this release is we no longer require updates for every node in the cluster. We no longer require approval from every node in the cluster to commit a change. We just need approval from a majority of nodes. So this way, if I have a 64-node cluster, I'm not waiting for 63 acknowledgments back, I'm only waiting for 32. So this way, we make sure that we can get a consistent view across a majority of our nodes. If we have a partition, it means that this site of the partition can all acknowledge. We don't have to wait for anything over on this site. Make sure our resources come online faster and more resilient. And again, this is only this will start to happen once you go and add that first virtual machine to your cluster, and it's only for Hyper-V VMs. So we change this update management as part of Hyper-V. Now, new cluster dashboard, I showed you some of the previews here already. There's been a lot of enhancements around the multi-site management. So if you go and add multiple clusters to Failover Cluster Manager, you'll get kind of a consolidated view of what's happening across all of these different clusters. We've talked about the nodes, different votes, and we talked about the disks. Now, one of the biggest changes that we have made is our Quorum model. So I'm going to spend a few minutes kind of first giving an introduction to Quorum, then talking about these different enhancements that we've made. Now, to provide some background, Quorum is our membership model. Quorum basically means that we need enough nodes in the cluster to be online and healthy for the cluster to be running. So what we always had to do in the past, Quorum meant majority. I needed a majority of nodes online for the cluster to stay online. If I didn't have a majority of the nodes, cluster would stay offline. Now, this was okay in a 16-node cluster, but when we got up to 64 nodes, and you lost 32 nodes, but still had 32 nodes remaining, we would shut down the cluster. You had 32 healthy servers, but yet you didn't have Quorum. We would take that cluster offline, wait for one more server to come back, bring it back online. Now, of course, there are ways to manually force it back online with forced Quorum, but as far as just kind of the general what happens in the background, that was the challenge. And so we've also added in 2012 a feature that was called preemption and also virtual machine prioritization. So let's say you had 64 nodes running. You lost half of them, down to 33 nodes. Oftentimes people would say, well, would these 33 nodes still be able to support the capacity of what was running on 64 nodes? Well, since we now have group prioritization, we will actually shut down low priority workloads and keep the high priority workloads online. So we're actually prioritizing workloads if there aren't enough resources available. Now let's say I have this node that's already running at full capacity. I want to bring a high priority virtual machine over. What it will do is call preemption, shut down the old one, keep the new one online. So as we start to even cut down to 32 nodes, sure, we have half the resources, but our most important things stay online. So we thought, okay, what happens if you cut it down to 16 nodes? Well, our most important ones would be online and our lower priority ones would stay off. We still have 16 healthy servers running our infrastructure. That should be enough, right? So what we wanted to do is say, hey, now we got these large clusters, we no longer have to say half is the threshold. We want to make it dynamic. We want to make it highly adjustable. And so what you're going to see in this release is we've got rid of our traditional cluster Quorum models. Got rid of node majority, node and disk majority, node and file share majority. Because you can now tune and configure what every node and what every disk is doing. Now, since actually 2012 RTM, we had a feature called node vote wait. Basically, you could say a specific node, you either have one vote towards Quorum or zero votes. You're just not participating. Now, we most commonly saw this in some multi-site cluster configurations, where we might have three nodes at a primary site, two nodes at the backup site. If those three nodes of the primary went down, these guys didn't have Quorum. They went down as well. We'd have to force it. So what we saw customers do was basically with these three and two configuration, they would say, two of them don't have a vote. Only one has a vote. This way, there's only 3 voters total. This guy goes down, still have majority. But that was kind of painful still, so we still wanted to make it more flexible. While you still have the ability to configure node weight, we're going to now try to make it dynamic. So dynamic quorum, what we are basically doing now is we will go and adjust your disk dynamically and turn it on and off as nodes join and leave the cluster. Now, it's important that we always have an odd number of votes. 3, 5, 7, 65. The reason why, anytime we have a single partition, there's always going to be majority at one side of that partition. Odd number. So what we wanted to do here is, as you had nodes join and leave the cluster, we will toggle that disk to always ensure you have an odd number of votes. So let's say you have a 3-node cluster. The disk will have 0 votes. One of those nodes drops out, we give you the disk a vote. So we're back up to 3 votes again. That node rejoins, take that disk vote out, back up to 3 votes again. This way we always guarantee there'll be an odd number of votes, and we handle all of this dynamically. So you don't have to do any special configuration. This is now built into clustering, part of our core logic. Now forced quorum will happen if you have an even number of nodes at 2 sites, there's a partition, second site's down, you need to automatically bring this up. Now, one challenge that we would have is, you know, if you have these 2 and 2, 2 nodes at site 1, 2 nodes at site 2, there's a partition, there was often a question of, you know, which side was authoritative. We'd have some challenges around split brain. So what we do, we just added a little bit of additional logic. Whichever side you call the force quorum on, we're just going to ensure that that side's going to be the authoritative side, because that's the data center that you may be sitting in, right? If you have a partition because of a disaster, you can't even physically access that other data center. We don't want that other data center running and actively working on VMs, even though we have no visibility into it. So by using this, what we will do is make sure that even if both of these data centers are running simultaneously, once they rejoin and speak to each other, the side that we say is authoritative, that's the side that will take control. That's the version of the cluster database we will use. And we tell this one that shouldn't have been running, but we never knew, you're non-authoritative. You're going to go take ownership based on our databases from the authoritative quorum. So essentially, if you have the split brain, multiple things running at a time, this decides who will be the winner. Now, part of another component that we have here is what we call a tiebreaker. Now, this is the case where maybe I have 2 nodes at each site. What happens if it's partitioned? By default, I want to pick one site or another. So we can now automatically assign which of the sites will be the winner by default if you don't want any manual intervention. The way we do that, there's a property that you set on one of the nodes on one of the sites that basically says this is the lowest priority site. It's called low quorum priority node ID, catchy name. And what we'll do, you get the site that has this lower node priority ID, that will be the non-authoritative site. This is the site that will come online, have quorum. Now, we wanted to have some integration with our management layer as well. As we started to see, you know, these large clusters running hundreds of virtual machines, we saw that we had administrators, multiple administrators using a single host. They might be sitting in different business groups, not talking to each other. One of them might apply a patch, reboot a host, and kill your VMs that are running on it. That's the problem. So technically, what would happen is it would wait for a little bit of time. It would try to gracefully shut down the VMs, but then it would just do a quick migration. So it would actually take that virtual machine offline, fail it over, bring it back online on the new site. Now, this was okay, but you know, quick migration means there's downtime. So we wanted to make this better. What we've now done is we have integration with the start menu, the restart button, that basically will wait and live migrate those workloads off of the cluster. So if you go and hit start, shut down, we're not going to wait 2 minutes and then kill everything. We're going to keep everything online, gracefully move everything over. Now, in some cases, you still might say, well, I only want to live migrate my high priority VMs. Don't really care about medium and low. We could do a quick migration with them. There's actually a VM property that you can set as far as movement type, which will say, I want to do a quick migration or a live migration. So you can't even granularly configure your VMs to say, high priority are going to live migrate, medium live migrate, low will just do a quick migration. A Hyper-V replica. Talking about some of our site recovery, made a few enhancements here as well. One of the biggest ones was probably the biggest feature request we had around the Hyper-V replica, different replication settings. In 2012 R2, you could replicate every 5 minutes. Pretty good, but we wanted to make it more granular. We now have the ability to replicate every 30 seconds. So if you have a high-impact business application, you cannot risk losing 5 minutes of data. Turn it up, replicate every 30 seconds. We then also had some customers that said, hey, 5 minutes is too fast. It's flooding my network. I don't want this additional traffic and additional noise. I only want to replicate every 15 minutes. So we provide that option as well. There is still no way to configure it beyond these three options. You have 30 seconds, 5 minutes, 15 minutes. There's no registry key, there's no hack, there's no other way to go and tune this. Always get that question. But this kind of gives you, you know, some flexibility if you're a local cluster, highly spread out. Now, another thing we wanted to do is add replicate chaining. Let's say you have multiple data centers. You want to replicate from my first to my second to my third. We now give you the ability to have replication upon replication. Go from our first site over to our second site. Now, here's an example. Let's say I have a metro cluster, meaning a small geographically dispersed cluster that will be resilient to losing like a block of power. Common one is New York, New Jersey. You got the Hudson between. They're very close. That's kind of the basic disaster recovery solution that most of our New York customers use, that Manhattan customers use. Have a backup site over in Hoboken across the river. Now, that's the type of thing where they have this critical data, a lot of financial institutions, a lot of law offices, and they want to replicate that near replication every 30 seconds, make it fast, make sure it's always available. But then they also want to protect themselves against a regional disaster as well. Hurricane Sandy. Doesn't matter if you're in New Jersey or New York, you got hit pretty bad there. And so what they can then do is do an off-site replication, a longer replication, over to the West Coast or over to Europe. And that might be a replication that happens every 15 minutes. So you have a lot of flexibility in how you carve this up to provide higher availability, better disaster recovery. There's a few other cluster enhancements that didn't really fit in that well anywhere else that are worth mentioning here. We have some proactive server service health detection. Basically, what we do here before failing over a resource to another node, before moving a VM to another node, we're going to check that that other node is really healthy, that all of the services are running, nothing's crashed, nothing's stopped. So we want to make sure that we're going to move it to a healthy host. We have proactive VM network monitoring. Same concept, but we're looking at the virtual networks on the new host. If you lose network connectivity on one host, and we live migrate you or fail you over to another host, and that also doesn't have network connectivity, not really going to help you, right? So we're proactively detecting the health on these other networks, on these other components. We have CSV coordinator node rebalancing. Now, one challenge that we saw in the past in 2012, so let me take a step back. The CSV coordinator node, this essentially manages our access to our CSV cluster shared volume disk. So you have multiple servers that are talking to this coordinator, in some cases passing data through the coordinator if you're in redirected access mode. And so this node can sometimes have a lot of traffic, most often it doesn't. Now, in our last release, we had no logic about the placement of these different coordinators. Each CSV disk has exactly one coordinator. And so what we saw over time is, you know, you might have a four-node cluster, four coordinators, a couple nodes fail, coordinator moves over, another node fails, coordinator moves over. Oftentimes, we started to see all of these coordinator nodes get stacked onto a single host. And then when you started to have lots of I/O, lots of traffic, that individual host was getting overwhelmed. So we basically built in distribution of these CSV coordinators across all the different hosts. So when a node comes online, let's say I have two on one host, zero on another comes online, we'll go and move that coordinator over. No downtime as you move a coordinator. We're essentially balancing this type of coordinator traffic. We added storage quality of service. So similar to network quals, you now have the ability to say whether a particular virtual machine can use how much of your disk I/O. This protects against problems like if you have a noisy neighbor, you have a virtual machine that's hogging all of the disk resources, preventing the other virtual machines on that host from using them. Not good, right? So we can throttle the amount of disk I/O that a particular VM is using. Likewise, we could assign a minimum bandwidth, and we can send an alert if a VM is not using enough network I/O. Sounds kind of odd, right? Why you'd want to have a minimum? Well, we found that we have a lot of VM sprawl, meaning that you have VMs that just aren't being used, running in the environment, still using a certain amount of resources for the memory, but they're actually not doing anything. So you could use this minimum network detection to find these rogue VMs that someone deployed, forgot about, that are using up server resources to help eliminate those. We also have improved login for our deployment and for our state changes. So this is essentially just helping you troubleshoot as you go deploy and configure your cluster. Now I'm going to quickly show you our network here. Oh, sorry, our live migration check-in. So I'm going to go back to my 2012 R2 cluster. My copying has been done. Quickly take a look at my roles. I can see those migrated roles have been moved over. Great. But what I want to do now is show you what changes in live migration. So this is a virtual machine that I have running. When I click live migration, I get to say move, live migrate, best possible node. Now what you're going to see here is instead of it starting to live migrate immediately, you see migration queued. This is where we're doing these checks. We're checking that the server is healthy on the other side. We're figuring out what's the best node. We're checking that those networks are healthy on the other side. Once we pass these checks, then you're going to see the traditional live migration process happen. But another enhancement that you're going to notice in this release is we now have live migration compression. We can actually compress the live migration traffic on the sending side, decouple it, decompress it on the receiving side. So we can actually do live migration significantly faster than our last release because we're compressing the information, sending less information over the wire. Now we're live migrating, the health checks worked, we'll bring everything online. Now a lot of people ask, did you see that setting when I live migrate that said best possible node? What exactly does that mean? Well, we spoke to the system center virtual machine manager team, and we said, when you guys are looking at host placement, what's the most important thing that customers have? Is it the CPU? Storage? Maybe, if it's SQL. Network? Generally not. Memory? Almost all the time. Everyone said, my network thresholds are most important to me. Sorry, my memory threshold is most important to me. So what we're actually doing, throughout the cluster running, we're actually constantly monitoring the memory utilization across all of the nodes in the cluster. And when we say move to the best possible node, we will automatically move that VM to the node that has the least amount of memory. So we're kind of doing some very basic memory distribution, memory balancing across all of our different nodes. And now we see that my live migration has been complete. Perfect. So let's talk about integration with System Center. Now, the enhancements that made to System Center 2012 R2 as they relate to clustering are, first of all, bare metal deployment of a scale-out file server. Now, remember our topology map, right? We have our host cluster, but below that, we have our cluster for our virtual machine storage, the scale-out file server, whack-whack my share across every node. Virtual Machine Manager can now deploy and configure scale-out file server clusters directly from VMM. It could also configure guest clusters. So essentially, what we can do through VMM is we could create those different layers. We could go create the host cluster. We could create the storage cluster. We could create the guest cluster. And we could create System Center high availability for the different management servers. So nice integration using a single interface to try to scale out and provide high availability. Virtual Machine Manager has also its own updating agent called Update Manager. Update Manager now supports additional roles that Virtual Machine Manager supports, such as this new scale-out file server. So you could automatically patch the scale-out file server cluster with zero downtime to your virtual machines. Now, as far as network virtualization goes, Virtual Machine Manager has a component called NVGRE, Gateway. Basically, this is when we use network virtualization in a tenant environment. And you have lots and lots of tenants that want their own subnet. Now, we have integration with that. So kind of what the scenario I like to talk about is our own offices at Microsoft. So we don't want to be limited by what all of the engineering team can do in their own office, right? I build lots of VMs. I build lots of clusters. Imagine if I was limited to the number of IP addresses I could use for my day-to-day job. If I only got 3 IP addresses, I could do a whole lot. I could deploy a 2-node cluster in one VM. That's about it. So the whole concept around network virtualization is to basically abstract each of these physical IP addresses, and behind one of them provide a new set of 256 brand new IP addresses. So make it highly flexible. Now, the NVGRE gateway basically is the intermediary between your corporate network that has a limited number of IP addresses and this tenant network that has however many IP addresses you want. So at Microsoft, what they've done is they've put all of this over on tenant networks. So I can deploy as many VMs as I want, have as many IP addresses as I want. Anytime I go from my own individual environment, go out to the corporate environment, I go through this gateway. Now, anytime a packet goes from my corporate environment back into this gateway, it needs to figure out where it's going to be routed to. Now, if you have a cluster on this side, and you have virtual machines that are moving and updating their IP addresses, we need to make sure that that gateway has the updated information as well. So now, if you have failover, you're moving resources around, VMs are changing IP addresses, the cluster will detect this, and it will go and tell the NVGRE gateway, update your routing tables, so as traffic goes in, traffic goes out, automatically gets updated. Now, System Center 2012 has seven other components, eight total, and all of them have some level of cluster integration. System Center App Controller is our self-service portal. We could go deploy VMs on a cluster. Actually, not just Hyper-V clusters, but even Citrix and VMware clusters. Configuration Manager allows us to secure our environment, make sure it's healthy, has the right type of software, patches, firmware. It supports clustering and CSV disks. Make sure that our VMs and our clusters are compliant. Data Protection Manager allows us to back up and restore virtual machines on CSV disks, even live virtual machines that are running and doing a live migration. Again, you could back up a virtual machine during a live migration now when it's running on a CSV disk. Endpoint Protection is our security and malware component that lives within Configuration Manager. This, of course, protects our clusters, protects our disks, protects our VMs. Operations Manager is our enterprise monitoring solution. Monitor anything throughout the stack from our hardware, file clusters, host clusters, guest clusters, applications running in those guest clusters. Full support of clusters, CSV disks, so you can see when disk space is running out. Orchestrator is our automation engine. Orchestrator, via Virtual Machine Manager, allows us to have cluster integration, deploy things to our cluster, bring resources online, offline. And it supports PowerShell as well. So even though there's no direct integration with failover clustering, you could, of course, call a PowerShell script. Failover clustering supports PowerShell, so you can have this automation by going through PowerShell. Service Manager is our IT help desk, ITIL-based system. It's also a self-service portal for our IT department. Full cluster support there. Reports clusters, problems with your clusters, problems with VMs running on the cluster. And now one special one that a lot of people don't know about, System Center Advisor. So let's talk about System Center Advisor. This is not part of the System Center 2012 suite. It is a cloud-based service that Microsoft offers. Essentially, think of this as a best practice analyzer that runs in the cloud. Now, the difference between this and Operations Manager is Advisor uses proactive monitoring, meaning it will detect problems before they happen. Operations Manager is real-time monitoring, meaning when something happens, it will raise an alert, let you know of that change. So what you can use Advisor for is basically test your environment, make sure that it is fully optimized, fully supported with clustering. Now, I've been actually had the pleasure to work with Advisor both on the design side, and now I actually use it in my own lab. What's kind of interesting about the way Advisor was built is we actually went through millions and millions of hours of real-world customer support data provided by our product support guys. We said, what are the most common configuration problems people have on our primary server workloads? So, Windows Server, Hyper-V, clustering, SharePoint, Link, SQL, and Exchange. What are these most common configuration problems people have, and how can we resolve them? So basically, the way Advisor works, you sign up online, systemcenteradvisor.com, completely free. You go download lightweight agents, and these agents will basically go and scan through the registry of all of your servers, looking for different registry keys, such as, do you have a specific patch installed? Do you have setting A or setting B? And what it will do, collect this information, it will then send it to a single server that's going to be your gateway server. This gateway server uploads it into one of our Windows Azure data centers, and we do all the processing in that data center, figuring out how you've configured your environment, how it's running, best practices you're following and not following. The key thing is, since we're basing this on registry keys, these are indeterminate facts. You either have something this way or you don't have it this way. And so what we could do is make recommendations based on these settings. Hey, you have setting A, you should do setting B. You're missing this hotfix, go download it here. So not only are we telling you about the problems you have, We're giving you the resolution as well, with links to go download these patches, to go fix it. Essentially, our goal here is to reduce downtime, give you higher availability by ensuring that your environment is as healthy as possible. Now, a couple weeks ago, we actually just announced integration into Operations Manager. So if you already have Operations Manager in your environment, it will actually use those SCUM agents deployed on the different servers. It will use your SCUM management server as that gateway to go and upload everything. And now, in the System Center Operations Manager interface, you can actually see the plugin for Advisor and see all of the problems in your environment. So please download Advisor. Please use it. It's a great resource. I personally use it in my lab. I have about 50 servers. We run about 700 virtual machines every day, and it found over 100 misconfigurations. So my staff was bad. They spent a lot of time fixing this up, but you know what? My lab's more resilient, less downtime, higher availability. So check out System Center Advisor. Now, as I wrap it up, I want to point you to a few additional resources. First of all, our TechNet Eval Center. Go download these betas. You're going to have access to Windows Server 2012 R2 in the near future. But also, make sure you check out Hyper-V Server, the free version. If you want in-person training, my team, the Evangelists, are running worldwide IT camps, which are day-long in-person training activities where you actually get a full day of hands-on lab experience for Azure, System Center, Windows Server. And those VMs are actually running in my lab. So you're going to have some good guarantee they'll be resilient because it's System Center Advisor approved. Then finally, we have the Microsoft Virtual Academy. www.microsoftvirtualacademy.com, free online training. Again, completely free, online, lots and lots of courses that will really kind of walk you through all the different Microsoft technologies. I recently built a track on Microsoft High Availability, so if you want some additional training, things such as multi-site clustering, check this out. I will continue to add the newest, latest, and greatest as we support Windows Server 2012 R2. With that, please, I encourage you to complete an evaluation. If you liked the session, if you didn't, you can don't do that. It's okay. And with that, thank you. Now, just get off the stage here, but I will take questions if anyone has anything. I'm also joined down here by Rob Heinemann, who's one of the cluster program managers as well. So please also feel free to direct questions over to him. Give me 1 minute, I'll get off the stage, and then I'll get down and talk to you guys.